Hey guys, welcome to episode number 12, and somehow I remembered that after all of South by Southwest. Episode is Circuit Breaker Podcast. I have two special guests here at South by Southwest, Madeline Martinair and Cameron, and I can never remember Cameron's last name. Ah, Burgess. Thank you for your badge. Let's start with Madeline. Who are you and what do you do?
Excellent question, Jax. Hey, Jax. So, Madeline Martinair, I have been heavily involved in the tech community and the maker community for the past 10 years. So I used to live in Dallas. I used to run two maker spaces, one in Atlanta, Georgia, one in Dallas, Texas, which is how we met way back when. And so most of my work has been around open source technology and particularly open source hardware. The story that I like to tell, I don't actually know if you know this, but so I was originally trained and went to school to be a science fiction writer.
I didn't think you knew that.
So I made the best worst mistake of making friends with engineers in college who promptly told me that everything I was visualizing for the future was already happening in the basement at universities that I was not a part of. So I dropped out, went to engineering school, got kicked out of engineering school. and then ended up in Dallas, where you and I met.
Yeah, I remember meeting you and hearing this like epic woman who taught Google engineers how to sew and take apart the sewing machine and put it back together again.
Well, so I got my way of getting into the maker movement was kind of backwards, right? So I have no formal engineering training, but I had gotten introduced to a variety of hackers and makers who were several of them who were working at the Google satellite office in Atlanta, Georgia, which was heavily involved in information security. And they had this crazy idea at the time. This was, 2008, where a lot of these guys had gone to CCC in Berlin and were starting to see this idea of maker movements and building these crazy labs and basements and things that look like spaceships, if you've ever been to one in Berlin, where you could go in and build things and break shit with no requirements of any kind. And so a bunch of these Google guys had come together and said, hey, can we build a lab like that in Atlanta where we can teach classes on engineering, teach classes on data and information security, and to the great credit of the maker movement, all of us were very inspired, were very driven by a movement driven, and had no idea actually how to run a business or let alone a nonprofit, which comes with a whole slew of tax implications there. And so I came in 2008 with my creative writing degree and said, hey, I think you guys are doing something really cool and I want to get involved. And how do I get involved? And I know how to write things, and I know a little bit of Photoshop by, like, some weird stuff, and, like, I want to get involved. And, like, you can write things? Can you talk to people? And I said, I think so. I don't know. They're like, great. You now run public relations. I said, wait. Hang on a second. You know, I'm like, I'm 18, and I have no idea what I'm doing with life, but okay. And so we built this space, and we got basically a zombie apocalypse bunker in eastern Atlanta that nobody, not even the pizza delivery guys, wanted to show up at. And filled it with a bunch of technical equipment and a full auto shop, and started teaching classes. And me being me, I have no idea how to teach any engineering classes, but they say, hey, you know what we've always wanted to learn, but because we're a bunch of engineers that never had any way to do this, and please don't tell our wives or girlfriends this, but we really want to know how to sew. I said, well, I sort of know how to do that. So I somehow ended up teaching sewing classes to engineers, which is not like sewing classes anywhere else where you actually teach them how the machine works. You actually have to take the sewing machine apart and put it back together again, and they go, oh, I get it. and somehow that works. And so, you know, through that, I actually learned some engineering and electrical engineering and how to solder and how to make things blink and move. And somehow I've built a career off of that, for better or for worse.
That's absolutely fantastic. I think that's all of us. I think
so
it's a
now
lot.
You know.
Yeah, that's impressive. And then related to the nonprofit stuff, we've got Cameron with us, who's in stitches because we've been giving him. He just now realizes the insanity of Madeline. I've known for.
He knows
forever,
what he got himself into,
and he's like, "Oh crap! What the hell just happened?" And he's laughing
whenever
so hard.
You're ready.
Yes.
I think if you grew up in Australia in the 70s and you're a boy, you're pretty much a maker. You know, like I spent my childhood ripping apart cars and putting them back together again and working on reticulation systems and pulling apart toasters and putting them back together again. And, you know, like from the age of five, my father was calling me from the backyard. We had a three-car garage with a mechanics pit. And so my first car, we pulled apart, we put back together again. That was my first car when I was 17. But from the age of five, he'd be calling me out to bleed brakes and do all this kind of stuff. And so I spent my childhood working on cars and actually making stuff. But, you know, along with that, advanced mathematics, classical music, music theory, playing classical piano, playing violin, viola and orchestras, like, so complexity thinking was part of what I grew up with without having any idea that that's what I was growing up with.
And then you became a troublemaker like the rest of us.
Right, yeah. Yeah, now I just make trouble.
That is awesome. So, okay, really quick, because I haven't seen Madeline in forever, and it's been a good South By. You guys, both of you and Cameron ran a workshop. What was the workshop? What's going on? You guys are continuing on the legacy of let's teach Googlers how to take apart sewing machines and put them back together again. And now you're changing the world in a new and interesting and awesome way.
Well, so I think so Cameron and I met June, July of this past year through a mutual friend and an organization that we both advise in the Bay Area. And I think through some of this crazy maker nonsense, you know, one of the things that I've learned in over the span of the past 8 years is that there's something in the thinking around the maker movement that I think is really integral to how we view technology, how we view innovation, and how we view kind of solving really wicked challenges, right? And so this ability, something that I learned through that process, was the ability to self-educate and self-organize, and the powers of communities of people that are passionate around a central idea and passionate about solving a certain problem, and their ability to break things, right? But also to solve really big challenges. And so I've spent the last 5 years in the Bay Area, kind of entrenched in Silicon Valley. And I think there's a lot to be said for what Silicon Valley is very good at, is thinking about innovation and pushing the limits of technology. What I don't think Silicon Valley is very good at is thinking. it's a lot
deep
of
introspection.
I'm gonna temper myself on this.
Self-awareness.
But what I don't think the Silicon Valley is very good about is thinking about how that technology applies to solving really grand challenges, right? And so we are living in a world, and we're living that our generation and the next generation are going to contend with some real existential threats about how we operate in this world, and things around access to renewable energy and access to clean water and access to food. And I think technology is a good tool for that, but I don't think we've had a lot of good conversations and good collaboration around how to solve those problems. And that's the technology is a good tool for that, but it's not a solution. So I spent a lot of time looking at systems of what are the integral systems that make us successful in solving those challenges. And Cameron has spent a lot of time working on that as well. And so we started bumping heads about what is the possibility, what needs to be done to actually tackle some of these challenges. And it's encouraging a level of collaboration and a different type of thinking than each of these industries, whether it's technology industry, whether it's government, and whether it's nonprofit sector and then the foundations, to get them to think collaboratively to solve these challenges. Because not one of these institutions, no matter how much money or influence they have, can actually solve those challenges. And so we came together to do this workshop as an opportunity to encourage that kind of collaborative thinking, and get them out of their silos and start thinking about what it would look like to solve some of these problems as a group. And you can speak to the scope of the challenge, I'm sure, in some of your work as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, so one of the things that Madeline just said, which I think is really relevant as far as Silicon Valley is concerned, is that Silicon Valley doesn't have, and we're speaking in broad sweeping generalizations here, which are always dangerous, including this one, that there's no moral imperative to solve a problem, right? Whereas if you're on the coalface dealing with, I don't know, let's talk about water sanitation and hygiene, right? It's a $1.7 trillion problem to solve if you're talking about sustainable development goal number 6. So there's a moral imperative to solve that problem if you actually believe that we should solve that problem. And so the opportunity in doing this work and running a workshop of this nature is really to hold up these people's and these organizations' values to themselves for radical self-reflection and to say, well, this is what you say you're about and this is what you're doing. These two things don't necessarily peacefully coexist. So you have to decide if you're committed to the outcome or if you're committed to the success of your organization, right? Because one has to precede the other. So what matters more to you? Does it matter more to you to save the lives of the 1,800 kids a day that die from completely preventable disease and lack of access to clean water? Or does it matter to you that your nonprofit gets funded?
Like, what do you care about? And the egos are huge, absolutely huge egos. And so what did you guys do? What was this workshop? How was it held? What did you guys do with the workshop? Like, who attended?
So we ran a design thinking exercise, which was positing. I mean, firstly, anybody who works in this space knows that the current way of going about solving wicked problems doesn't work, right? Like, everybody knows, and no one generally admits. And so we go about doing things the same way that we've always been doing it. So that was where we started, right? Like, basically, do you agree? Yes, we agree. Okay, good. That's a good start, right? So let's not keep doing the same thing. And so we basically grouped the participants into three primary groups that related to the work that they were doing within their organizations and got them to identify the resources, the capital they had available, talk about the types of functions that their organizations fulfill within a marketplace, agree to a new shared outcome that their organizational outcomes laddered up into, and then redistribute their capital towards the achievement of that outcome. And the idea was not to abandon the needs of their organization along the way, but to say, well, you can do both, right? But we're never going to achieve the greater outcome if individually we keep focusing on our organizational outcomes. We have to come together and shift our point of focus to a much, much greater opportunity.
Okay. So what happens next? Like, now my question becomes, you guys had this great workshop and clearly people realize they need to start sharing resources. You know, we talked about, I know offline outside of this podcast, and that's why I'm bringing it up now so our listeners can actually hear. We talked about certain major world events that have happened over the last year and a half, right? Hurricane Harvey unfortunately hit Texas fairly hard. And as much as aid was going down there and we're a first world country and everything else, it was the redneck Cajun Navy, which is a bunch of guys who literally show up and you're like, you barely speak English, you barely do anything, and you're showing up in lifted trucks and hoverboats and will probably kill a crocodile or something along the way, or an alligator, whichever is in North America. You'll probably kill one of those out in the bayou, but you're the better emergency rescue force that ended up helping save Houston more so than FEMA did, right? So that's clearly a problem, and that's clearly, like, again, going back to, that's a you know, all these kids are dying because of malnourishment or simple diseases or whatever that might be, and there are larger ones. And so, you know, we also talked about Doctors Without Borders as far as a greater world ability to circumvent some of these issues and really think outside the box and things like that. The bigger thing is so how do you guys go about design thinking on that, and what's the next step after the workshop? So, you know, they got together, they finally figured this out, and they know they need to change themselves from a bigger structure. But what's next? What's the big outcome of this?
So there's a couple mindset shifts that need to happen, right? So I've spent a good amount of time spending work in humanitarian development, and the Maker Movement has a lot of ties to humanitarian development. There's a great organization called Field Ready that does a lot of work on the ground in disaster areas. One of their facilitators, Dara Dotz, who I just saw earlier. We've had many conversations about this, and I think there's two big things that come to mind for me. One is, in an instance like Harvey, right, there is a huge dichotomy between what is actually happening on the ground versus the large systems and infrastructural issues that we're talking about, which has to do with how these organizations are structured and how finance flows. So there are incredible organizations that come on the ground in any sort of disaster like that that are solving actual problems. Their best role, and a lot of the grassroots organizations are working very closely with organizations that you referenced, right? And so they're very good at tying into the existing community on the ground. So I think there needs to be better collaboration and better understanding of how something like that happens on the ground in those moments, and where the finance and the organizational structure comes into play. The other is that we have to be careful about making a distinction between aid and humanitarian aid and development. And right now, those areas are very disparate, right? So if you talk to people that are working in aid and humanitarian aid, they view themselves as a whole different organization and different function than development, right? And I think that's just the current structures. I think there needs to be more collaboration and overlap there, definitely. But I think what we're trying to achieve in this workshop and in doing subsequent workshops and subsequent projects in this is changing the mindset that this is a problem that can be solved by one organization or a variety of organizations running on their own tracks. Because nothing will get solved that way.
So you know, one of the funny things, and going back to this, and one of the rewinding of why South by Southwest originally started, but calling it interactive and design thinking and getting all these disparate organizations connected and everything else. You're absolutely right. I mean, people are not talking to each other and things like that. And so now, just kind of thinking about the Dallas startup community that we both came from, Madeline, you and I. Cameron, unfortunately, you have not had the pleasure of this community yet. You will at some point. But, you know, you talked about an email thread that kind of solved another major world crisis. I don't know if it was last year or year before last, which was an email thread. And instantly in my head, you know, I'm a tech guy. I think, holy crap, why didn't they do Slack? Why didn't Slack all of a sudden just pop up and solve this problem? Why instead of an email chain, you know, can you break out all the different chat rooms and say, okay, this one's medical, this one's, you know, necessities for something else, and this one's necessities for something else, or this is search and rescue, or we need to find Fred, so we need this other Slack room chatted, opened up, or things like that, or how do I get transportation solved, or things like that. So, one is, how do we get those the disparate organizations to start thinking that way, one, and then utilizing technology a little bit better in the sense of utilizing, one of the other things is Cameron and I got stuck in an IoT conversation trying to make houses better, but realistically, you know, there are other cool things. Last night there was a guy who came up to me and he was like, yeah, you know, I want to use drones. And this is like about the third time. I got a call from another buddy of mine earlier and he was like, yeah, we're taking the fire trucks and we're literally just extending out the ladder as far as possible, which again goes back to Cajun Navy doing this, but it wasn't the Cajun Navy. It was another buddy of mine. They literally were trying to find somebody in the field. And so they basically parked up the big ladder truck, pulled the ladder all the way out, climbed up all the way to the top. And they're like, hey, look, we can see. And it's like, you guys could have gotten a drone for that and done it that way. And he's like, yeah, that's not a bad idea. Let's go get a drone. And so, you know, Slack is the basic one, right? Everybody has Slack on their mobile phone and the mobile phone's there. But then how do we get them like baby steps, right? Thinking this way. And clearly you guys started that with the design workshop. So what's the next step?
I think one of the critical components is to have people stay in the swim lane of where their expertise is, right? And so even with technology, you know, if you talk to technologists, typically people presume that because they know one area of technology, they know all of them equally well, which is clearly utter bullshit. And so part of what, you know, we're consistently trying to do with these kinds of organizations is to get them to take a step back out of the presumption that they know best how to execute on designing systems and implementing systems, and focus on why they're doing what they're doing and what they're trying to do. Because the how of it, they're not necessarily the best people to answer the question of, right? So they don't know how to think about functioning collaboratively, deeply collaboratively. They don't know how to think about or action collaborative funding or you know, rolling their projects up into a sort of a larger single entity. It's not where their expertise is. And so typically what happens is you get these blockers, and they're saying, well, no, that will never work, or we tried that, it doesn't work, or someone else tried that, it didn't work, right? I think one of the key challenges in the impact space or in world positive organizations is that technology can and should be a massive enabler. And most of these organizations, I mean, one of the things that I'm always saying is, if you're not in the business of building technology, you have no business building technology. Every nonprofit should stop building tech. Every social enterprise that is not a technology social enterprise should stop building tech, right? They have no business doing it. They don't know what they're doing. They're wasting time and money. Like, their systems are so functionally retarded in the true sense of the word, right? Like, in the true sense of the word, their systems are functionally retarded. They don't know what they're doing, so they shouldn't be doing it. Because if they recognize that there was the opportunity for even just next door, whoever the nonprofit is next door, for them to share bandwidth or share Slack or share data in a way that would actually help them get things done better, then things would get done better and faster. And there's a moral imperative. We've got 12 years to solve a $50 trillion problem that nobody, no single person, let alone a collective of people, has any fucking idea how to solve. And we've got all of these organizations running in parallel, duplicating effort, wasting time and resources, saying, oh, we've got the answer. Going, no, you don't. You have a small subset of a subset of a subset of an answer. Like, the smartest person in the room is the room. It's a 7.5 billion person room. The answers are in the aggregate, not in the individual.
Madeline, you and I come from tech.
Yeah. Well, I agree and I disagree on a few points. But I think so, coming from the technology side, you and I in particular can see all of the ways that technology can fit into this. And so we look at it and say, why aren't you using drones for this? Like, why aren't you using Slack for this? And the realization is actually, when you spend time inside of these organizations and you spend time talking to people that work on these substantial issues day in and day out, you have to realize, and I just spoke to a woman who was a director at one of the major foundations, and she mentioned, and we had the same conversation, and I kind of approached her in that same way and said, well, why aren't you using Slack as a great example? And she said, you need to understand that most of us are working off of Windows 2007.
So, wait,
she's like, and very simply, and it was so appreciative, because she said we get approached so many times by technology organizations that want to help, because and I see this coming, you know, spending the last 5 years in Silicon Valley, there's a lot of people that are technologists and that fund technology that are starting to look at this and say, am I going to have a world to live in 30 years? Are my children going to have a world to live in? And so then they start looking, and what they know is technology. What they don't know is these institutions that have been working on these tackling these problems for decades, right? And so I don't think the way that it's being done is right. I don't think either of us do, right? I don't think technology is the answer. I think it's a tool. But I think what the point of what we were trying to achieve in this workshop, and where we absolutely agree here, is that you have to focus on the people you are trying to serve and the outcome you're trying to achieve, right? And you and I have spent time in accelerators. We've spent time in design competitions, right? And what is the one thing we always end up having a conversation around is, who is your customer?
Yeah. No, and I absolutely agree with you. And this is why I was poking on the design thinking workshop. Recently, another friend of mine, who I got both of you guys in touch with here at South by Southwest, that's one thing I love about South by Southwest. Without this, I wouldn't have met you, Cameron, and honestly reconnect with some good friends and do all this stuff. But rewind from that is the good friend that I got you guys in touch with. He taught me the design workshop sprints. I didn't understand what he was going on about. He was just banging on and on and on and on about a design workshop and a design thinking, design sprint and everything else. And intuitively, I think Madeline, you and I have done this over and over again. And clearly, Cameron, you've done this over and over again. Just intuitively, we've done this design thinking, designs workshop because we go ask, what's the problem we're trying to solve? We don't go, oh, well, we can throw this stuff at it and just constantly throw things at it. That's not the right way to approach it. And I think the most successful companies that I've talked to every single time, especially on this podcast and outside of this and everything else I've done, has been always like, okay, wait, what problem are you trying to solve? You know, there's the age-old story of the guy at the assembly line. They have this problem where the assembly line runs too fast for boxes to fill thing. And so, you know, they shut down the assembly line. They put these billion-dollar sensors in. So every time a box, you know, is unfilled, it stops the assembly line. They pull the box off, and then they go on. And all of a sudden, like a month later, the alarms are not going off anymore, and they're like, wait, but we didn't make anything faster or better, and all the guy did was stick a fan at the end of the assembly line, and so all the empty boxes just blew off on the side, and every once in a while he cleans off the empty boxes. And it's like, it's a low-tech answer to a high-tech problem, or, you know, a high-tech solution that didn't need to exist. It's stick a fan and you're good. And it's the same thing in this case, right? These nonprofits, I mean, in one hand, I didn't even know Windows 2007, 2000, whatever the hell it is, I didn't even think that was possible to run, so I don't even understand how they're still running it. But clearly they are. And at the same time, you know, we can kind of aid them to... They're clearly using iPhones, or they're using some sort of modern mobile device. I mean, my favorite was I was on the top of Machu Picchu, which is the middle of literally beautiful spiritual experience, middle of nowhere, and yet I still have cell coverage. So clearly there's ways to do interesting things. The flip side is... After natural disasters, and I keep on poking in this because it's the best way I can understand like stuff you guys are dealing with, is we watched Puerto Rico like literally get devastated by not one, but I think multiple hurricanes, and just one hurricane just literally sat on top of the island, and they have no electricity, no cell service, no anything. And so you're back to solving very basic problems of how do you get from point A to point B. And then how do you get everybody from point B back to point A with supplies going in and then things needing to come out again, right? Basic things like, okay, do we pull the injured people out? How do we take care of stuff that, frankly, were problems in the 1800s and then just kind of went away because modern infrastructure helps us take care of it all? Like basic services like you don't even think about, like plumbing or trash collection or something like that. So... You know, your design thinking workshops are helping us think through those basic problems of, well, technology is not going to solve that. It's actually what's the solution we're going after and what are we trying to solve for? So, you know, the other excited part about this workshop is what's next? What are your two things that are coming out of this workshop? Well, I think that's like my closing thought, just because I generally don't run this podcast more than 30 minutes. So unfortunately, you guys have like... 5-minute answer for this. What's going to happen next with both of you guys?
I'm going to add a comment to that, and then I'm going to switch it back to Cameron. And just the one thing I want to say is that these are not the problems that we are trying to solve are not problems that can be solved in a 54-hour startup weekend, right? So just the identifying the problem and who we're trying to solve is monumental. But this is not something that you can workshop in a startup weekend and come up with the magic answer, right? And because these problems are so complex, you know, both on the technology side, but from an economic perspective, from a governmental perspective, there is a fantastic book that I was actually looking this up on my phone that I recommend here. It's the author Rebecca Solnit, and she has a book called A Paradise Built in Hell. And she highlights a series of natural disasters that have happened globally and the communities that are built out of disaster. And what I like about that book is she highlights so many of the inefficiencies that happen inside of a disaster, but the community organizing that happens. Well, why I like that book so much is I think she does an incredible job of identifying the complexity that is involved in solving any of these issues. So as I keep like beating the drum here that like technology is a tool and not a solution, is that we need to identify the problems that we're trying to solve, reduce the ego involved in this, and care less about who's the one to solve it and just solving the problem. And so that anything that we can do and some of the work that we're doing here is trying to build that mindset and see what comes out of that.
Yeah, that's I mean, that's the core question, right? Like, do you want to be the one to do it, or do you want to see it done? And so as a core defining question for working with these kinds of organizations, when you ask that question, it's very hard for them to say we want to be the ones to do it, even though that's how they behave, because often they've just never been asked that question, right? And so I think that, I mean, look, as much as I may beat on some of the operational dysfunction of these kinds of organizations, and I've made a career out of it, they're all typically like really, really smart, really passionate, really hardworking, really, just really dedicated people who are using their skills, resources, and talents to the best of their ability to make the right ding in the universe, right? They don't think that solving a problem is, oh, I live in Silicon Valley and I need a way to figure out how I can use Bluetooth and smart IoT technologies to keep my coffee at the perfect temperature all day long, right? That's not the definition of a fucking problem, right? That's techno-narcissism at its best. It's yes. Insanity. So you know, really what we're looking for with this is to we co-authored a paper called From Billions to Trillions, which is available if you search for it on Google, that thing, you'll find it, which describes a framework for helping these organizations to collaborate at unprecedented scale to actually be able to go and solve these kinds of problems. So for us as a dynamic duo, you know, the work that we want to be doing more of is going into these types of organizations, all these types of events, and facilitating these kinds of experiences that help organizations that are focusing on wicked problems to recognize that there is another way that they can go about addressing the problem at a meta level, still achieve the outcomes that they need to for their stakeholders, but actually wind up solving a problem that really deserves being solved.
Okay, so you mentioned a paper. How can people find you? Where do they find you? Where are you found best? LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat?
I'm on all the socials, probably Twitter at Uncompromise.
Okay. And Madeline?
Twitter at M Martinair.
Okay.
The best one.
So that will be in show notes, and I will have the links there, and I'll have those LinkedIn profiles too, unfortunately. And I'll put the paper in there as well, and then I'll put the book that Madeline referenced. Anything else you guys want to plug, talk about, what's coming up next? I see lots of shaking of heads and no. So thank you so much, and this is the great podcast from South by Southwest.